Welcome to Counter Stories, the show by people of color, for people of color, and everyone else. I'm Holly Lee, owner of the Other Media Group and producer of this show.
I'm Luz Maria Fias, Deputy Attorney General with the state of Minnesota. Any and all comments made by me are strictly my own and should not be attributed to my employer.
I'm Don Eubanks, associate of Dendros Group and a member of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe Indians.
And Anthony Galloway, pastor of St. Mark's African Methodist Episcopal Church in Duluth, Minnesota.
And we have two special guests. I'm so happy that we were able to make this work with our two special guests today, Sarah Super and Asma Muhammad. And why don't you guys introduce yourselves? We'll start with you, Asma.
Hi, everyone. My name is Asma Muhammad, and I am the advocacy director at Reviving the Islamic Sisterhood for Empowerment. And I'm also a survivor and an advocate for people of color, for people in movements in different spaces.
And hi, everyone. My name is Sarah Super, and I am the founder of Break the Silence, which has been a grassroots collective of survivors of sexual violence organizing to dismantle rape culture and support other survivors in their healing. I am also a rape survivor and have had the privilege of getting to work with Asma on this in this work for the last several years.
Thank you both so much for joining us. We have been doing a series talking with lawmakers about the session and kind of what's been happening and issues that may affect our communities. And then I saw on Asma on that you had been involved in this movement and the progress that you guys had made this year. So could you guys like give us a Asma and Sarah, could you guys just let folks know what that was that you guys have worked on and were so successful in passing this year? Although I know you've been working on it for more than a year.
So for the past 4 years, Asma and I had taken on the desire to eliminate our state's statute of limitations for reporting sexual violence. So until this year and until September 15th of this year, people who were sexually assaulted in Minnesota had a time limit for when they could report what happened to them. And we just found it to be a arbitrary barrier. There's so many barriers to kind of seeking justice or seeking accountability from the person who caused harm or the people who caused harm. But one of those barriers was just simply a time limit. And so we sought to remove that. And after 4 years of lobbying, it finally happened.
Sarah, what was that arbitrary number?
You know, it actually ranged, and it in part depended on what year the sexual assault happened. So this is a bill that's been looked at and changed before. It used to be a more narrow window and was expanded, but it also carried with it the confusion of not just, abiding by the law as it existed in the year that you were assaulted or abused, but also the age at which you were assaulted and the age of the perpetrator at times. So there was a different time limit for people who were minors and for those who were adults. But roughly speaking, it was about 9 years.
So there were actually statutes in place that not only limited how long you had to be able to come forward with a horrific event like this, but it was broken down according to your age. So if you were a minor, did you have more time or less time? Not that that's important. I'm just trying to help our listeners kind of understand the complexity and the differences.
Yeah. So one thing that we found is that that there was a lot of compassion for minors and that, you know, rightfully so, that there were people who were ready to advocate for a child victims of sexual abuse or sexual assault. And so in some cases it was 9 years and in other cases it was 6. It depended on the nature of assault, the age of the parties involved. And there were even people that we worked with who said, well, I understand if, you know, kids are having a hard time coming forward because maybe, you know, they grow up and then they finally realize their trauma. But the way that psychology works and the things that we've learned about psychology have shown us that trauma works the same in our brains as it does for even children. So there are survivors who have experienced sexual assault, maybe at age 25, at age 45, at age whatever, who are also experiencing that feeling of not wanting to come forward for several years because that trauma is there. And people, again, like I mentioned, had that compassion for children and weren't showing the same compassion to adults who had been victimized and had been sexually assaulted.
So Osmond and Sarah, so that implies then that it was a shorter window for adult women to report. Is that correct or incorrect?
In some cases, yes. So in some cases, incredible. It was 6 years. In some cases, it was 9. It depended also on, you know, how with minors, even it depended, like if it was a 16-year-old and a 21-year-old, I think there was a, there's a numbered month. And I remember I worked on the state workforce for reimagining what we could talk about with criminal sexual assault and all these different statutes, because there are a lot more issues than just the statute of limitations. But one of the things was there, I can't remember the exact number, maybe it was like 120 months or something between the perpetrator and the survivor. There was just an arbitrary number between like how the age of the two parties involved, and it made no sense. And a lot of it just didn't make sense. It was like, who chose these numbers? Why do they even exist? Who chose 6 years? Who chose 9? Why? So I think what we wanted to do was make the playing field level for everyone, so everyone could come forward and report whenever it made sense for them, because this arbitrary timeline doesn't work for everyone, obviously.
Right. And beyond just the psychology of it, there's all the reasons why people choose to stay silent, you know, whether they might blame themselves or whether their community might explicitly have blamed them for what happened to them. There's also a lot of fear that by coming forward, they'll see the perpetrator or the community will, you know, retaliate against the victim. So in other words, the statute of limitations, it was like as if you could keep if you can keep a survivor quiet for however many years, after that time, that perpetrator is no longer able of being held accountable for what they did. Or in other words, it decriminalized sexual violence if a victim was able or willing or forced to stay silent for a certain amount of time.
I think it's worth noting right now what we mean by the community and the pressure of having the survivor tell the story and come out. I know within certain cultural communities, and I'll speak on behalf of the Latinx community in particular, there's a lot of shame, you know, going around. And depending on what the circumstances of it, whether the perpetrator was a family member, for example, or the perpetrator ended up having some form of relationship with the family, meaning not a stranger, or say, for instance, the survivor is a young woman just entering adolescence and having that attack then be something that she has to hide because culturally she's afraid of all of the ramifications coming down on her from everything from her father and her brothers trying to seek and avenge justice on her behalf, or her being disowned out of shame from parents, by her parents. And I can give you examples, you know, of all of this. I mean, the first example that immediately comes to mind is when I was in high school. I was born and raised in Chicago, in a barrio, and I remember with distinction that one of my best friends, when she was a junior in high school, we went to an all-girls school because our parents were so provincial about what it meant. They had an impression that the U.S. education system was very sexually promiscuous. And so they intentionally then wanted, at least my family, her family, and many others in that Catholic school, wanted to, quote-unquote, protect us from that. And I remember her one day calling me, and she was just crying uncontrollably on the phone. And I finally was able to get from her what had happened. She had gone to church that was 3 blocks away from her home. It was a nice warm day outside with family and friends. And she decided, her family walked home, and she decided to stay outside of the church and talk to girls, other teenagers and guys. And before she knew it, the guys kept kind of cornering her or leading her over to her their car. And out of nowhere, they shove her in their car, and they take off with her. So they basically kidnapped her, and they proceeded to sexually assault her, to rape her, in a group of 4 guys over the course of 2 days. And so she went missing for 2 days. And after they were done with her, they dropped her off in her neighborhood where she had to walk home bloody and, you know, looking just really disheveled and in a state of shock. And she comes home and she ended up getting into big trouble with her family because she'd been gone for 2 days and was unaccounted for. And they thought she was out there doing whatever, drinking, or, and she didn't drink. And she never told her family about being raped for 2 days by multiple men. And I kept asking her, you know, can I take you to the hospital? Can I take you here? Can I take you there? And she couldn't. She couldn't muster that strength. And to my understanding, to this day, she has not disclosed that she had been raped, kidnapped and raped for 2 days to her family.
Wow. I mean, as a woman, I can say, like, you know, I think there are statistics like half of every woman in the world experiences some sort of sexual assault or sexual violence. But you're right, Luz. It's like, you know, in our community, you're basically reporting a rape twice if you want to report it to the police, because then you got to report it to your community too, right? So it's like, especially if the person is from the community, if you're both Hmong, you know, then there's a lot of like, you know, you're airing our dirty laundry type of thing. You know, I feel like a lot of times it's like people are more ashamed of having like somebody in their family who was the assaulter than somebody who was the victim. I mean, in the sense that's like, you know, if like I've heard people in the community be like, oh yeah, that guy went to jail for a while because, like, you know, he molested his cousins or whatever, but don't talk about it. Don't talk about it. And it's always like this very hush hush, like it's, you know, it's shameful to his family that he's related to them. And it's so shameful that I think that's what causes other women in the community to not speak up, right? Because then they'll be blamed for bringing that shame versus this dude and what he did. It's the classic victim shaming in that sense. They're so ashamed of people knowing that there's a perpetrator within their community, their family, their circle of friends, that they're willing to let the survivors suffer and suffer in silence. And well, Sarah and Asma, you know, you mentioned that it took you 4 years. Why did it take so long? I mean, you know, when you think it, I mean, to me anyway, in my brain, I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, obviously it's something like this is very traumatic. You know, they should have as much time as they need to report it. That's what my brain says. So, you know, when this issue was brought up, I'm surprised, like, why did it take so long?
White men. That's the simple answer. When we first brought it up, it was 2017. Ilhan was the House author and Senator Sandy Pappas was the Senate author, sorry. And we had worked with Ilhan because she's a friend, and she listened to our stories. And Sarah reminds me that we sat in her office for hours that day just telling her our stories. And she listened and said, absolutely, I'll take this on. And that's what we found with a lot of the Posse Caucus and a lot of the women of color that we encountered. So when we passed it on to Aisha, Representative Gomez, the following year, and then when we finally passed it on to Representative Hollins this last year, we never got any pushback from them that said, no, you shouldn't be doing this. It isn't the right time. They never said anything like that. But we kept hearing that from the halls and halls of white men, especially in the Senate, who told us this isn't the right time, or what about false accusations? Just conversations that were irrelevant. And I remember there was a representative who I was looking for because we were shopping around the bill, which basically means, you know, you're collecting signatures. And I was trying to talk to this person because he was on the Public Safety Committee. And when I asked him about it, he said, well, what about false accusations? What about people like Brett Kavanaugh? As if he was not guilty. And I was like, great, this is not the conversation I want to be having. And there were even conversations there, and I know Sarah remembers this because we had Sarah and I were friends. So whenever we look at each other a certain way, and a lot of women have this, when you look at someone a certain way, like, you know that it's time to go. So Sarah and I had this like signal. It was like, okay, if we feel unsafe in someone's office, we're going to go. And there was even a legislator who, once we brought this up, said that he didn't want to support the bill because of false accusations and because he had even been falsely accused by his own daughter. And at the moment he said that, Sarah and I looked at each other and we're like, let's get the hell out of here. Mm-hmm. It was scary in moments. And there were so many people who know that this will impact them. And I think that's another thing that scares me. There are people. So this law is, it's not retroactive. It impacts people who are assaulted on or after September 15th, 2021. So anyone who's been assaulted in the last 2 weeks now has the rest of their lifetime to report. And there are people in those halls in our Capitol who know that, knowing that, you know, that there will be violence that occurs maybe at their own hands. And I believe that. I think that they want to protect perpetrators. They know that the vast majority of perpetrators are doing this continually. They're doing it over a series of years. And I know that these perpetrators are trying to protect one another.
Asma, you couldn't get the legislatures to agree to make this retroactive?
Oh my gosh, no.
Incredible. I mean, that I know
because there are people that are, and we know this, there are people who will be impacted who are in positions of power right now. And there are people who have a vested interest in silencing survivors.
You know, at one point in time, I was Commissioner of Health and Human Services for the Mille Lacs Band, where I'm enrolled. And the first time it was probably, I went up there in 1998. And sexual assault, sexual abuse is a taboo subject in the American Indian community, much like I'm hearing Luz explain about the Latino community, much similar to what Hilly's saying, and then very similar to what you just said, Asma, in terms of because I'm a social worker by profession. And so when I became commissioner the first time, I started to try to open up dialogue about sexual abuse. It's one of the backside to the experience policy that was put in place to eliminate our culture and our language by creating boarding schools and sending our children to boarding schools. My mother was sent to a boarding school. And one of the backsides, and there are many backsides to that episode of American Indian and U.S. history, is the fact that many of these kids were sexually abused when they were in the schools. That was never dealt with. And as they became adults, they began to perpetrate within the American Indian community. It remains a taboo subject. And in Oswego, it just blows me away because I experienced the same kind of pushback. It took me a while to realize that I was pushing against a system that might include elected officials or highly recognized elders in our American Indian community. It was that same thing. I realized the more I pushed, the more resistance. And the resistance wasn't loud, it was a stone deafness. Does that make sense? And the harder I pushed, it took me a while to realize that I might be uncovering many buried secrets that folks wanted to keep buried. But to have our elected officials display that same type of behavior kind of just blows me away. I can't believe they would not have made this a retroactive law, allowing everyone the freedom to have as much time as they need to report this. It literally blows me away.
Yeah, I mean, we actually wanted this to be, when we first talked about it, the first thing that was told to us, from what I remember, Sarah, and you can expand on this from what you remember, is they're not going to pass this if it's retroactive. We were just told that flat out. And even for those 4 years that we worked on this, we struggled this hard saying, like, this will not be retroactive. We had to make certain that we were saying that constantly over and over, because there was just no doing it. People were like, no, it cannot be retroactive. So we were told from the beginning, like, it's not going to be retroactive. And we said, okay, we'll take what we can get. And even this small feat took 4 years. So I can't even imagine how long a retroactive piece would work. Sarah, you want to say more about that?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things too working against us was, I mean, we were two volunteer lobbyists, you know, who were equipped with our own personal stories and the solidarity of other survivors and allies who we had connected with here in the Twin Cities and across Minnesota. But, you know, there would be international forces such as the Catholic Church or, you know, the national level, like Boy Scouts of America, all of these large institutions that would be pushing against it. They would come equipped with their lobbyists who, you know, we already in Minnesota opened up what was known as the Child Victims Act, which did lift the statute of limitations for filing a civil suit. But not reporting through the criminal courts. And so we have seen in the past few years a rise in the number of people who've been able to sue their perpetrators. And we do hear those stories of adults who were victimized as children who are now, you know, suing the Children's Theater, suing Boy Scouts of America for the abuse they faced as children. But the criminal aspect of it, I think, would just be, it just feels those organizations would be pushing down and would have, you know, smushed us in a second, including the legislators who we know. I mean, we know that people, that perpetrators, you know, that we have perpetrators in our community, and there are certainly people who've committed these kind of wrongs who are sitting in office. By lifting the statute of limitations and having that be retroactive, it also opens up those people to accountability that they fear.
So, Sarah, I appreciate your last comment here, and I want to jump in and echo what you're saying. And the thought that immediately comes to mind, along with what was said previously, is Governor Cuomo from New York and the amount of notoriety and the amount of cases and women who were empowered to come forward after that first person came forward. And then also Larry Nassar, who served as a doctor for USA Gymnastics and who molested girls, I mean, minors for over 20 years, and how that was kept and suppressed by the organization. So to your point, Sarah, there are many institutions that exist locally, nationally, internationally, that it's in their interest not to allow this level of awareness, this level of accountability through laws and prosecutions, in addition to the civil remedies that you spoke about, to come to bear. Because otherwise, then, you know, it's Pandora's box. It's opening up, and then all of this stuff comes out, and then people are no longer able to exert their power the way they have had in the past, and they've got to start all over, so to speak, in trying to inure themselves to other leaders for political reasons and political favors. And it's really sad. In the piece that came out in the Star Tribune about the efforts the two of you have led, what struck me, it didn't surprise me, but really resonated with me, that there was a survivor of assault, Billy Dinkle, who had been watching your work collectively. And then he opened up about his abuse as a boy in the 1970s and reached out then to his legislator, which is Representative Athena Hollins, to see if she could consider sponsoring the bill. And then thereafter, there were at least a couple of other men, another representative, John Hewitt from Rosemount, that also opened about him being abused by a priest as a child. And one topic that we've talked about in Counter Stories often in the last 8 years that we've been on the air is this, is that too often when male victims come out, there's this automatic credibility to them that it happened. You don't have to have 20 of them say that it happened. One voice, one victim is enough, so to speak. But yet it flips completely when women are on the other end, and the allegations of, is this true? You know, has it been corroborated? Is it a false accusation, right? And we don't see that level of scrutiny when we're talking about male victims. And it's just offensive to me to see that continues, right? It's all part of that pattern of men having more credibility, not only as victims or survivors of sexual assault, but also being in the chair, right? That if the two of you are telling your story, that's not enough. It's only enough or legitimate when male survivors come forward.
Sure. yeah, I mean, I think that is how rape culture works, and it's how patriarchy works, is that men are believed in most situations. And I think that one thing that I noticed was 3 years ago when we had our first committee hearing, Sarah and I both spoke, and we were immediately verbally attacked by several members of the committee. And it's recorded. It was awful. It was traumatizing. And then we reconciled with those members of the committee. This time around, I testified and Billy testified, and then Representative Hewitt shared his story as well. And the bill passed through that committee unanimously for the first time. And I think there is something to say for people who change their positions over time and realize that they were wrong and, you know, want to correct that wrong. But I think there is also, there is power in survivors coming together. And I appreciate Billy and I appreciate Representative Hewitt coming forward. And I believe and value their stories and all that they brought to this fight with us. And I also do think that there is something to be said for women, like you said, not being believed and us needing to bring more power because our stories were not enough, when we know that they are. Our stories are enough, and what happened to us should never have happened to anybody, and we should be able to report if and when we want to.
And I think to add on to that too, it's we have just seen that, like, people, society, they just care more about men. I think there's more care or belief or credibility given to male victims. I also feel like a lot of this conversation has been about ensuring due process, which we, you know, strongly believe in, isn't even working in favor of those who have been victimized. But there's just so much care and consideration that's just bestowed upon men that is very different. And so, you know, again, one of those barriers being the question around due process, like the statute of limitations doesn't change due process. It only allows for due process to occur. But we just do see, and again, it doesn't mean that, you know, being, there are so many men who've been sexually abused. We know our prison system is full of sexual violence. We know that childhood is full of sexual violence for boys and girls and people of all genders. But we're not saying there's any easy way to be a victim or survivor, but there are identities that make it harder.
Can you talk about that a little bit more, Sarah?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm white and I'm a female, straight white female. And I was raped in St. Paul in like a nicer neighborhood. I was renting an apartment. And I just think about how much my gender, my age, my education status, you know, where I was living, how much that impacted the response that I received, which was timely, compassionate, validating. People took my case seriously. And I mean, this, a lot of the same privileges and more so were bestowed upon my straight white male perpetrator. You know, Alec Neal, who raped me, he raped me just a few months before Jamar Clark was killed. And, you know, as we talked about the response of domestic violence and firearms and all this and that, you know, I raised the comparison of like, this man, my ex-boyfriend, broke into my apartment and raped me at knife point and fled the police at 100 miles per hour on the highway. And yet he was taken into custody without harm. So clearly, you know, social identities play a large role in the way that people interact with the justice system.
You know, hearing that, I have to self-reflect just on the amount of work it takes to address the imbalance of response. You know, a corollary that's talked about quite a bit amongst my own students are, you know, what happens with folks who are involved, mass shooters who are white and male, and their treatment by police officers versus those who are just have the suspicion who have been killed. Because, you know, because you bring up Jamar Clark, and I can't help but wonder if the resistance, you know, to, or the privileging of male bodies is because if I accept or I acknowledge the problem, then I have to also deal with my own implications in it, my own participation in it, my own benefit from it, from callous joke to actions that if somebody else gets caught, I then have to, I'm exposed myself. There's something about that seems to me being the underbelly, the part of the undertow of resisting, you know, addressing the statute of limitations.
So another question that comes to mind when you were testifying and getting this these changes passed with the legislature, did the issue of rape kits come up and how so many rape kits are destroyed across our state? I know, looking at an article that says that in 2020, the report was that over 450 rape kits in unsolved and uncharged cases were pending there, right? And that they were destroyed because of the statute of limitations issue in part. And also, I would imagine some funding restrictions, you know, that these police stations may not have had access to funding to be able to then further test them and go on with the investigation. Did your testimony or your exposure to the process, did that surface at all with these rape kids conversations?
Yeah, and I'll just pipe in quickly only because that was the one part of the law, the existing law, that didn't have a statute of limitations was for people who had forensic evidence. So rape kits being the way to collect that forensic evidence, that was really at the time the only way that there was no statute. But I think to your point about the backlog of rape kits, it only helped us paint the picture that the system has failed to, you know, respond to sexual violence in a meaningful way, in a way that was supportive of survivors coming forward and that took their pain seriously.
And I mean, tens of thousands of rape kits have been destroyed. So there's more. And it's a national problem. And I don't think it's that the police don't have funding. I think that they're misusing their time. They're not putting resources towards this. Police are more well-funded in the U.S. than anywhere else. And they're more well-funded than any other agency that I know of. So I don't think that the money is the problem. I think it's prioritizing survivors and their needs.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
I'm sitting here, there's so many things going through my mind with what Sarah and Ozma have shared with us. I don't even know where to start. I mean, you know, Sarah, thank you for talking about and explaining a little bit about the identity thing, because I think that's, you know, that's so key to, you know, many of the different topics that we talk about here on Counter Stories, and so much I think a part of our lives as folks of color from that come from various different indigenous and other community BIPOC communities here in the United States, and how our identity impacts how we are perceived and how we are treated in this country, and to have you share that, you know, because you know we dealt with Jamar Clark here, or we talked about Jamar Clark and that whole dynamic that you just brought up, using your own experience as a backdrop, and we talked about what Anthony talked about in terms of when Dylan Roof walked into a church and shot and executed, what, 9 people? And then the police took him to Burger King because he was hungry. I mean, you know, we talk about those things. And I think often, depending on who's listening, I think it's easy for members of the dominant culture to kind of dismiss what we say, you know, that it's not believable. And to have you share that, is a great example of how those differences are meted out. I mean, I'm a male, and I'm well aware that as a male, there are certain privileges that I afford, even though I'm a male of color. Just being male affords me some privileges, unearned privileges that I have over women. As I just found it incredulous that a legislature would use Brett Kavanaugh as an example of someone being falsely accused of sexual assault, and the trauma that creates for someone like you or someone like me as a person of color, when we would bring something forward and then it would be turned around and used against us. It's incredible how that dynamic works.
Earlier this year, we did our first in-person recording. We went to Mille Lacs and Donna showed us around, and we did a show around missing and murdered Indigenous women. And one thing that our guest, Missy Whiteman, had said was, you know, a lot of times when there's these movements for survivors, we neglect the well-being and the work from the advocates. And so, you know, for the two of you being both the survivors and the advocates, you know, how is it, like, I can't even imagine having to live through such a trauma and then having to fight and being getting pushback from the white guys who are so afraid of it, you know, being both advocate and survivor.
I personally, I don't think I would have had it any other way. There have been other people at the helm of different movements who shouldn't be because they're not directly impacted by the harm that's being caused. And I think because Sarah and I, this was a survivor-led effort, right, by Sarah and I, we were able to connect our hearts to it. Not saying that other people who are not survivors can't connect to it in the same way. I mean, they can't. I am saying that. but I think it was really helpful knowing that we had a personal stake in this, that we, even though this law is not retroactive and I can't report my perpetrator, I still believed in this for myself, for my students, for my community, because I knew how harmful it was to not be able to report. And I wanted people to have the opportunity to do so. So I think having every movement led by the people most impacted is incredibly important, because otherwise these movements are co-opted. They're led by people who don't understand the pain, don't understand the trauma, who won't be able to live out, you know, what the change that they're trying to create.
You know, Sarah, Asma, I agree with you. I mean, mine wasn't as traumatic, but at one point in time, I was state director for alcohol and drugs, and I'm also in recovery. And it was very hard for me to attend national conferences with other state directors who talked the talk during the day, and then at the end of the day would all retreat to the bar and proceed to get drunk. There was a dissonance there. The work that you two have done is absolutely incredible. I mean, and it just blows me away that the Boy Scouts of America, the Catholic Church, would oppose what the efforts that you were doing. But then you think, you know, on NPR in the past 2 days, it's been announced that the Catholic Church in France now has come out with their report. Why it took them so long, I have no idea. But apparently from 1950 up until just recently, they're saying that they have over 300,000 cases of abuse, sexual abuse by priests in France. And so, I mean, this is not it's not anything that is going away. And it just blows me away that I just can't get over the fact they wouldn't make it retroactive.
When she named those organizations, though, Don, were you surprised by? I mean, I don't think, like,
no.
Yeah, it's like, oh, that's a real bummer, but also, like, not surprised.
No, I wasn't. I mean, but a little. I mean, you know, they're both tied up in a civil litigation, but why would they oppose criminal charges? I mean, yeah, so you know, that still kind of blows me away a little bit. I mean, civil, you know, they're going to be paying out, and rightfully so. But why not? Why oppose criminal charges against those individuals? That I don't understand.
So, Don, to me, that actually makes absolute sense to me why folks would oppose that, because what we are the consciousness raising is doing now to me, if I'm just going to look at myself, you know, if I don't oppose it, then I have to, then I'm culpable, right? Or not culpable, what is it? Then I'm at risk of having to deal with my own behaviors. And this is something that hits real close to home for me. We've had to do some really huge family work because of what is coming to light now, and things that people have tried to hide, including folks who themselves had faced that had experienced that abuse. Their abuse was so total that we had to work hard to get folks in my own family to come forward and deal with things and with folks who are still alive. So I personally see a whole lot of reasons for folks to try to oppose that, because if I don't, then I leave myself open to having the my own accountability come to bear. To me, that seems to me the reason why folks would oppose it.
You know, Anthony, you make a good point. We've talked about different sources of types of perpetrators, whether it's folks in the church, whether it is folks in, you know, Boy Scouts, organized type of nonprofits. We've talked about elected leaders. We've talked about former boyfriend, Sarah, that was your attacker. But what we haven't really talked about yet is other, and there's so much of this is about power, right? Other institutions where power is inherent, and then it's easier to prey on a young person, whether it is, for instance, physicians or educators, right? I think about one case in particular of a physician who groped a young girl who was very close to me. I'm not, of course, going to disclose her name or my relationship to her. And that has never come to light either, because she was just so ashamed at the thought that she trusted this physician. The child's mother was outside of the exam room when it happened. And this physician was not held accountable. And I know I've read articles along those lines as well. And then, of course, the media is replete with examples of educators, both men and women, who prey on young students as well. And into college and universities as well. So when we think about the spectrum of these attacks and assaults on the survivors who ultimately are able to move forward, again, to just reinforce what has been said, your ability to impact and make change in the law is really remarkable. And I think it's going to be really important for us to make sure that we, on our Facebook and social media, share the number or the names of the nonprofits and other entities that are there to help support survivors of sexual assault and molestation. And I'm not sure if you want to go into that now, but we definitely need to be able to empower folks to feel strong and let them know where these resources are in the community so that they can then seek recourse and help on their way to heal.
Yeah, so Sarah, I know you founded a group. Is it for a group for victims, a group for survivors, and do you guys have any recommendations for folks who might be listening who might say, I know somebody or I experienced something and need some help?
That's a big ask. And it's certainly maybe the most important one, because in reality, friends and family are not only our first responders, the real first responders, but they're also the most important. That I think so often what survivors need first and foremost is the validation of the people who care about them, that their safety matters, that their survival matters, that they have friends and support. And so, you know, one of the first and sometimes most challenging things is to believe what a person is saying when they say they've been sexually abused and sexually assaulted. It's a whole lot easier to believe a person telling a story when the perpetrator is, a stranger to you. The real test of character and progress, I think, is really when we're hearing someone tell a story and they name someone that we actually know who's caused them harm. And it opens up a much, it challenges our own belief system and our own ability to, you know, discern people's character But believing survivors is at the very foundation of support. But it goes so much farther than that. I think one of the things that Break the Silence has really been about promoting is understanding the nature of trauma as an experience of being forced or rendered powerless or held captive, being forced against one's will. It's an abuse of power. And so one of the ways in which we can intentionally help rebuild people's sense of power, in addition to, of course, working towards equity and justice on larger macro scales, is also offering choices on a interpersonal scale. And so, you know, we've recognized that even, you know, a lot of this work has been about creating spaces where survivors could say their names and tell their stories if they wanted to. It's a very different thing to say, let's do this, or I did this, you can do this, than to say, if you'd like, and if you'd find it healing or validating or helpful, there is this option of telling your story. You could tell your story at an online event. You could help us, you know, by testifying at this legislative thing. You could, creating options for where stories can and can be told. And then also ensuring that, like, this is not the right way to go about healing, or the better way, or the stronger way. It takes a lot of strength just to keep living in the aftermath of sexual violence, let alone to hold that suffering in silence and to watch the person who harmed you or the people who harmed you to never be held accountable. So what we also did, and on top of, you know, offering people the choices of speaking out or engaging with us, was saying the words, you know, if not, that's okay too. We stand with you however you choose to heal. And really offering that as a safe opt-out, so people knew it was safe to say no or to say they weren't interested. Again, it's like these parallels of engagement, of marketing, of growth, often play into a lot of the similar kind of coercive tactics of people who've done some immense harm.
Yeah, I wanted to touch on one thing that we say a lot, and Sarah does a really beautiful job of doing this, is we don't want every single survivor to report if it doesn't make sense for them. That wasn't the goal. It was to give survivors a choice, because we didn't have one prior to this. And what happened to us was, as Sarah mentioned, an abuse of power, or we were not given a choice, right? So when we opened this up, we opened it up as one option for healing, if that makes sense for that survivor, right? So for me, I wasn't ready to report for many years, and now I am, right? So if I wanted to report, I would hopefully, you know, well, I can't now, but we wanted to open up a choice for other survivors, because healing does not happen in a linear manner. It doesn't happen the same way for everyone. It's definitely not one size fits all, but we wanted to give another option to folks to heal however they want to, if they want this to be a part of their healing, because for some people it is, and some people it's absolutely not. It's re-traumatizing. So to give people the option is really important. And I think Break the Silence does a really beautiful job of that. And we also say, you know, you can be a part of this organization or this group. And if not, that's okay too. And Sarah does that again really beautifully and lets people make choices, because I think that is the most important part of this, is giving people a choice where there wasn't one before.
One more thing that we should mention before we run out of time here is the work that you've done in fundraising for a Sexual Violence Survivors Memorial, and ultimately building it and having it installed then at Boom Island Park. Can you give us some more information about that and what your vision was and the impact that's had in our community?
The memorial was really kind of the first thing that was set into action. Of course, when I was raped, I had no intention of starting like a local movement or a nonprofit. But when I chose to speak out, I decided to call all of the media outlets who had originally reported the crime report the day following the assault. And it ended up being like a feature in the Star Tribune. This was back in April of 2015, just 6 weeks after the assault had happened. And one of the unexpected outcomes of telling my story was that hundreds of other people told me theirs, that people were reaching out to me and telling me not only their own personal experiences, but also often that I was the first person they were telling, or the first person who believed them, or the first survivor they were connected to. And I recognized this incredible pervasive nature of sexual violence, but also the lack of healing and validation and support that this population, which is huge, and probably uncounted or numerous in many ways, since it's so unreported or underreported, I just felt like there was something that we needed to do to validate people's experiences and the importance of how a community responds to rape culture or responds to injustice in all its forms. That silence to injustice is not a neutral response. And that's often the response that people give to this issue of sexual violence, including feminists, right? Whatever, however we want to define that, that there are women who consider themselves and men who consider themselves feminists who do not know or understand the dynamics of sexual and domestic violence. And so there just needed to be, you know, I guess what I will say is that the common response to sexual violence is either seen as this very private micro scale between like the victim and a therapist or the victim and the advocate, or it's seen on a very macro scale as in, you know, the relationship of the victim within the criminal system or the legal system. But there is this middle part that seems to have gotten stepped over in terms of, And it could potentially be the most important part, which is the support of a community. And so the memorial itself was really intended to be a symbol of solidarity with survivors at a community-based level, which took about 5 years to create. We worked with the Park Board. We worked with mosaic artist Lori Green. We worked with landscape architects at Damon Farber and just numerous survivors and allies who contributed, made personal donations to make this memorial a reality. And almost exactly a year ago, we dedicated the memorial, and it's now a permanent fixture in Boom Island Park.
It's amazing. Congratulations. Yeah, that's beautiful. Congratulations.
Thank you both so much for joining us and for doing this. You know, I'm sure you guys are getting that a lot and you deserve all of it. So thank you very, very much. I'm Halili, owner of The Other Media Group.
Luz Maria Frias, Deputy Attorney General with the State of Minnesota. Any comments and opinions I've voiced are solely my own and should not be attributed to my employer.
Don Eubanks, Associate of Dendros Group and member of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe Indians.
And Anthony Galloway, pastor of St. Mark's African Methodist Episcopal Church in Duluth, Minnesota.
And our two wonderful guests.
This is Asma Muhammad, the Advocacy Director at Arriving the Islamic Sisterhood for Empowerment.
Sarah Super, founder of Break the Silence.
Thank you very much. This program is a co-production of the Counterstories Crew, The Other Media Group, and AMPERS, Diverse Radio for Minnesota's Communities, with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.